Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Well, it's important for me to now to get some facts on on the program straight, because that the book is going to be a reference guide as well, so we need to clear that.
Okay.
So if I can just run this over with you, and if you can make some comments,
okay,
just to see if I got it all right. Your television program, The Roy Rogers Show, was on for 30 minutes, and it aired on CBS.
Well, it was first, it's NBC. We started to make the first in 51 through 57. It was on NBC at that time. And then I got the pictures from NBC, and we started on CBS. They started to syndicate them. And Nestle's came along, Nestle's chocolate, all our products. They were sponsored in several areas as being syndicated, and they wanted time identification with it. So they put it on, we took it off of syndication, and they put it on the CBS network for 3 years. And then when they finished there, why, then we syndicated, and it's been all over the world.
And
still playing in some areas now, down in Houston and in New Orleans and different places. A lot of the places where my restaurants are, they are restaurant sponsors.
Then too, when we do a fair sometimes, a state fair, a rodeo, the people, you know, the station will get them and play them. And the fair board, you
know. Start a couple of months ahead of time with the TV station.
And advance to, you know,
start
advance
a
of
following
our,
and
right, Because some of the little kids.
A lot of the little kids, anywhere from 4 on up to 8, 10, 12, a lot of them don't know you, you know.
And in my case, I'm 25 years old, to give you some idea where I fit in there. I haven't seen it for a long time, but, you know, I can only go so much. I can only go on my memory so much.
That's right.
Now, in your program, you had a double R Bar Ranch in Mineral City, and you were owners of a diner.
No, I was.
Dale was.
You were.
I was, and Pat Brady was my cook, he drove Nellie Bell the Jeep. And he was the cook, and Roy was.
With Bull, I was a sheriff for
sheriff
of Mineral City, and. What was the fellow who played the sheriff? And I was I was a floating guy. Was one sometime I'd be this or that or the other, different things that helped the sheriff or the marshal or
a
game warden or whatever it happened to be.
That's right.
And Bullet was my dog and Trigger.
No,
and
mascot.
And Dale had her little horse Buttermilk.
Yeah, not Buttercup, Buttermilk.
Buttermilk.
All right. He was a gelding. He was not a she. He was a gelding. I mean, I get to ask that on the road all the time when I've gotten concerts, you know.
Well, we'll get a
Was Buttercup, but was she a nice horse? I said, Buttercup. It wasn't Buttercup, and it wasn't a she. His name was Buttermilk, and he was a gelding. Okay?
Yeah, all right. Now, Sheriff Potter, I have a Harry Harvey.
That's right.
That's the name.
I was trying to think of Harry's name. I haven't seen him for years. I've got one of his hats out there. I want to put it in the museum. He wore that.
And I have Mayor Ralph Cotton, and he was played by Harry Lauder.
We had different ones. Now, they weren't steady. Harry Lauder played in quite a few of them, and a lot of the stuntmen played parts too, played heavies. And also did stunts in the pictures.
Now, the orchestra was Lou Bring.
I guess. I don't know.
I want to mention all I can.
Yeah, it was Lou Bring. Did he do the orchestrating on our... I don't know who did it. We filmed over at Golden Studios. So I don't really know.
I didn't know.
I'll tell you who you can check that with. Check that with Art Rush.
Art's been our agent for 35 years, so
he
might
know. He might know. Contracts on
now, Frank Worth did all the music on those were our radio shows.
Yeah, that's radio shows. That's not.
But he did some backups, too, on some of our pictures. I think he did some of our pictures.
Well, it would be well for you to check Art Rush.
Yeah, right.
And,
and the
number is 9. You got a pencil
yeah,
there?
Got
oh, oh, okay.
985-3033 in North Hollywood.
And I have some more names. Bob Nolan.
Bob and I started, I was the first of the Sons of the Pioneers, and Bob joined me. We sang duets together, and over a period of the next, with a group called the Rocky Mountaineers, and over a period of the next 2 years, we formed the Sons of the Pioneers. And that was in the early 30s. And the Sons of the Pioneers today go on the road with us. Of course, it's a younger group, you know, as one would leave why or retire or something would happen to him. They'd replace him with another fella, and they still got a great group, and they go with us on our fairs and rodeos and things like that.
Do you want to mention the group you have now? Do you want to mention
the Sons of the Pioneers? They have Dale Warren and Roy Lanham.
If you can add their musical
stuff. Dale Warren plays bass. Roy Lanham. He wants the instruments too.
Oh, Dale Warren plays bass, Roy Lanham plays a guitar, Billy Liebert plays the
accordion.
Rome Johnson plays a straight guitar and sings in the trio. And let's see, who's the other one? There's five of them. Who's the other one?
There's four of them, aren't there?
No, there's five of them. Oh, Rusty Richards.
Oh, yeah, that's
Rusty
right.
Sings tenor, either beats a little tambourine, or if they need another guitar, he can double on a guitar. He plays several instruments. Yeah. Each one of them plays different instruments.
My memory is vague on this, but I think I saw you on a Carson show with them.
We did a
really good, clean
sound. Yeah, we did. I'm going to do... Diana Shore's show in May with them. No, is it May? May 22nd,
mm-hmm,
yeah,
so.
This
yes,
month.
Yes, uh-huh.
I'll check with your manager to see when that airs.
Yeah, he's got all that dope. And,
that'd be good.
I tape all I can tape.
Yeah. You
know, I don't know what we're going to do yet. Probably something we can do that we already know.
Mm-hmm. Now, it started on October 4th, 1951, and went through to September 19th, 1964. Does that sound right?
What's
that? Your program, The Roy Rogers Show.
On network?
51 to 64.
That sounds about right, because it was 6 years, like 6 years.
NBC.
And it was 3 years on CBS, 3 or 4 years on CBS, and then we syndicated it all over after we got released from the networks. That time they were allowed so many stations, you know, so many across the country for a network, and there's a lot of them that didn't belong to the network, so we syndicated them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have 188 Republic Westerns?
No, all together. That's including the Westerns at Republic and our TV shows.
I see, all together. And tell me a little bit now, if we can just kind of go back for a moment. How did you start with becoming involved with motion pictures? I mean, did you have a hero when you were going?
Well, I think in a nutshell, it's awfully hard to tell several years in a few minutes.
Yeah, I understand.
But basically, I came to California in 1930 to visit my sister, and we were out here 4 months. And out in the museum, you'll see the old car I came to California in 1930, and we stayed 4 months and went back to Ohio, and I took one look at that winter coming on, and I hated those winters.
Yeah.
And so I hitchhiked back to California, and I've been out here ever since. And that was right during the Depression, 1930, in the fall of 30, and right on into the 31, 32, when it was really rough. And I did anything to get something to eat, you know. I drove a Model T dump truck for a while until a guy lost his trucks and my job went with it. I helped move some houses down around Hawthorne, Lawndale, and Englewood. And then I went up north in the San Joaquin Valley and picked peaches with the migrant workers from Oklahoma and every other state, I think, at that time. and people were traveling trying to find work. And from there, I when the picking season was over, I went back to Lawndale, where my sister lived. And there was a radio station in Englewood that had a program on her every Saturday night called the Midnight Frolic. And anybody could get on it. So my sister just made me go up there and get on it. And I played the mandolin, guitar, and sang and yodeled. And they took my name and address. And about 3 days later, I got a guy came to see me, and his name was Eb Bowen. And he was the leader of a group called the Rocky Mountaineers. So I joined him. I was the only singer, and the rest of them were instrumentalists. So I talked them into running that in the paper for another singer. Bob Nolan was a lifeguard down at Santa Monica Beach. And he answered the ad. And there's a lot of little things that can be told, which we don't have time for. But Bob and I started doing duets together. And then we... Bob had a friend that was a beach louse, so to speak. They laid around on the beach down there and sang and played the ukulele. His name was Bill Nichols. So Bill came with us, and that was a trio, the original trio. And after about six... Huh? No, no, that was the Slumber first. We called him Slumber, Bill Nichols. And Bill and Bob and I worked together for a while, and Bob, he couldn't take it any longer, so he quit. We were living off of chipped beef and gravy and anything that we could get. And Bob quit and started caddying at Bel Air Country Club. And then we ran an ad in the paper, and Tim Spencer answered it. And it was Tim and Bill Nichols and I. It was a trio. And then we couldn't make it in that group, so we joined a group called the International Cowboys. And out of that group came five guys called the Oboro Cowboys, and we barnstormed down through Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, and raked up enough money down in Lubbock, Texas, being on the radio station and playing the little theaters around, and dances and stuff like this, to get back to California. We got back, and I joined a group called Jackney's Texas Outlaws at KFWB, and Bill Nichols went back to Oklahoma with Lloyd Perryman. I mean, back to Texas with Lloyd Perryman.
Was it right there on Hollywood Boulevard at the time? KFWB upstairs?
It was Sunset Boulevard, there where KTLA is right now. That used to be the KFWB, the old Warner Brothers studios in there. And that was Warner Brothers. And so Tim went back to work for... Safeway Stores. I went on Jackney's Texas Outlaws, and Slumber went to Texas with Lloyd Perryman, which later became one of the Sons of the Pioneers. And I got in touch with Tim. He was working for Safeway Stores, and I said,
Tim?
Yeah.
For Safeway?
Yeah. And I said, Tim, what do you say we go out and talk to Bob and see if he'll come back with us? As long as we're on this good station, and we had a chance, because they had two-hour shows we were doing a day. Mm-hmm. So we went out and seen Bob. I always had a set of wheels of some kind. I had an old beat-up automobile we got around in, and Bob accepted. So we holed up in a little boarding house down on Carlton Way, just off of Bronson, and we rehearsed. When our rehearsal was over, is when our voices gave out. And we started getting good harmony. And when the last roundup came out, Bernie Milligan is a columnist, entertainment columnist on the Examiner at that time. He started giving us plugs on in his column, The Best Bets of the Day. He had a column called Best Bets of the Day. And when the last roundup came up, we made a real good arrangement of it. And we always had good harmony, had good blend and everything, and we got our words together at the same time and all this. We worked on the details. And so he gave us a terrific write-up on the last roundup. And so this drew attention to the heads of the KFWB, the manager of the station. So a week or so after this write-up, they call us in and wanted to know if the three of us would quit Jack and his Texas Outlaws and come on the staff. They had a staff orchestra there, Jack Joy and his orchestra. And, well, we were tickled to death, $35 a week apiece. That's more money than we'd ever dreamed of. We were living in this boarding house for $9 a week, room and board.
Imagine.
In those days, yeah, so that you can see what it is today. $9, you can't buy a pack of cigarettes hardly today. But anyway, we learned about 300 or 400 songs. None of us could read music. We'd get records and everything else trying to learn these songs, you know. And we built up quite a repertoire. And so when they pulled us off of the group, we needed another name. And we couldn't use the Texas Outlaws, so we were known then as the Pioneer Trio. So we got to kicking names around, and I don't know who mentioned it first, but it came up, the Sons of the Pioneers. Because Hugh and Carl Farr's mother and father were actually pioneers. They came across in that Cherokee strip run back in Oklahoma.
They did.
And they had raised in Breckenridge, Texas. So that's how we came up with the Sons of the Pioneer name. So we were on the staff for 2 years, and we asked for our release in 1936. We were all healed up pretty good by then, $35 a week for 2 years. Yeah. And we wanted to go to the Texas Centennial. So the governor of Texas had contacted us and invited us to come down. So we thought that was terrific. So we went down, stayed for about 4 months, and came back.
You're already down there, right?
I was on WFAA on the staff, though I didn't know the boys.
And at the same time, she was on there.
At the same time in Dallas, I was at the
WFA.
Yeah, the Dallas Morning News Station. And I was a staff singer, and I was on a program called Early Birds, which came on for about 2 hours every morning, with a fellow, pardon me, named Jimmy Jeffries, a little round fellow, a real fat fellow. It was a MC and a fellow named Eddie Dunn. The two of them, and a full orchestra, and you know, just sort of kibitzing and singing and one thing another. And I was doing dance band work with Ligon Smith in Dallas and Herman Wallman. They had dance bands, and they were in that area, throughout that area. And I didn't know Roy, though. I sang ballads and jazz.
Mm-hmm. Popular stuff.
Popular stuff.
It's difficult because there's two different stories here, but I want to go back to you in a moment.
Okay.
So I'll finish mine right quick here.
Yeah.
I'll bring you right up to the...
Lost. Right. Well, come back to you.
We were there for 4 months and came back and signed up at KNX with Peter Potter, and he's used to do the Peter Potter Platter Parade in the early television. He had a radio show called the Hollywood Barn Dance, and it was put on out in the women's club about West Hollywood Boulevard, out by the shrine, by the Masonic Temple. And we were there when I heard that Republic was looking for a singing cowboy, and to cut a long story short, I went out there, and they had already tested about 17 people at this time. And they liked me, and so I signed up there October the 13th, 1937, about a year after I came back from the Texas Centennial, and I was there 14 years. And then that's when I quit there and started my TV show, our TV show, both Dale and I.
I understand you were in a few pictures with Gene Autry.
Yeah, we did, as a group, we worked in quite a few pictures. Charlie Stair's pictures and Nick Foran at Warner Brothers, and we did some comedies with Joan Davis and also L. Brindell at Max Sennett Studios. And then we went to Republic and did background music for some of the westerns they were making out there, including a couple in Gene's pictures. And in fact, by being in those pictures, when I got ready for the test, I told we were called out there to do background music for one of his pictures or one of the other pictures. I forget, one of Gene's or one of the pictures they were making. And so I told the director about it. Joe Kane was his name. And he said, well, I'll see if I can help you as far as getting a date set for a screen test. So they called me out there in a day or so, and they had the screen test. And by working in those others, you never know who sees you or what contact you made. And it's a long story how I got in the studio and everything, but we'll go on with that. But I was there for 14 years.
Okay, I have a lot more questions about that.
Yeah, so okay.
Let's start with you, Dale. How did you get started in show business? How did that begin? Did you have, what were your parents like? I'm going to ask that of you in a minute, Roy.
Well, actually, my family was very much against my being in show business. And there had never been anybody on either side of my family that had been in show business or really had any hankering to be, you know. And but I always liked, as a little girl, I loved to sing and to recite. And, you know, as a matter of fact, I wanted to be a ballerina when I was a little girl, but I was never allowed to take any dancing. And so and I was in my mid-teens, and I lived in Memphis, Tennessee, and I was a stenographer for an insurance company.
You from originally?
Uvalde, Texas.
Uvalde, Texas.
Mm-hmm. And we moved to Arkansas when I was 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in, by the time I was 15, I was in Memphis. And when I was about 17 years old, I was working for an insurance company. And for a claim adjuster for several insurance companies, you know. And I was supposed to type up those claims, you know, those accident claims. And I was always, I played a little piano. I'd studied a little piano. And I was always trying to compose songs. I love to write lyrics. I was always fooling around when I was supposed to be typing up those forms.
Typing music in your head.
Right. And that my boss came in one time, and I was late having my workout. And he said, what are you doing? What are you doing with your time? What were you doing when I came in? I was humming, you know, and trying to write a song. And I said, oh, I like to kind of write songs. He said, do you sing? I said, well, I enjoy singing. I used to sing in operettas, you know. I had a very high voice when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I used to have a little band. When I was in high school, I played piano, and a couple of girls played ukulele, and one of the boys played drums, and we used to play for parties and mm-hmm. stuff like that, you know, just goofing off, just goofing around. And he said, well, would you like to be on the radio? This is way back now when radio was just really getting off the ground, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, well, of course I'd like to be. And Rudy Valley was the real hot shot at the time. He was mm-hmm. really big, you know. And so he said, you come down. This is Friday night. This is a small station in Memphis. He says, I have a part in a paper stock company. And he had a very pretty tenor voice. And he, 15-minute program. He said, I'll put you on. And he sort of dared me to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. And the program, the station liked it. And I remember I did a song, Mighty Like a Rose, which is a spiritual, you know.
What name did you go by then?
Francis Fox.
Francis Fox.
Mm-hmm. Francis Fox.
I have a name.
Because I had,
of,
I had
of
my
a Fanny. Fanny.
No. Well, that's later on. That's so later on.
It was another name.
Fanny. Well, this goes way back. My father, I was really supposed to be Fanny Octavia Smith. But I had an old maid aunt who had a sister-in-law named Fanny that she didn't like very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first grandchild in my mother's family. And this old maid aunt was quite prominent, you know, prominently there. And she sort of took a shine to me when I was born. And she said, she will not be called Fanny. We're going to call her Frances. So that's the way I came by the name Frances. My name was Frances Octavia Smith, but I'm my first marriage, I married a man named Fox, Thomas Fox,
mm-hmm.
and I had a son by him. and I was quite young, and then he left me, and I had was forced to get a divorce, and which I didn't want to do, but finally had to. And then that's why I wound up in business offices. I went to business college, mm-hmm. and then worked for several companies, Buick Motor Company and Gregory Bus Line, and then into the insurance company. So they gave me a program once a week, 15 minutes. I stayed there about 6 months. And then the biggest station in town, which was WMC, the Commercial Appeal Station, mm-hmm. offered me a spot there. No pay, you know, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. for a lark.
Yeah.
And I took it, and I was on, like, the news at noon with the news. I had a 30-minute program with a newscaster at noon. And then I went from there. I started doing all kinds of dates, like civic clubs and dances for Elks and Shrine and all that kind of business, which I did. I did get paid for some of those, but luncheons I didn't, of course. And then I went to WREC, which was the CBS outlet at the Peabody Hotel. And I was there for quite a while. And then I tried Chicago, but this was during the Depression, to break into radio there. I had, you know, pretty fair name in Memphis at that time, mm-hmm. as a radio singer. Mm-hmm. But it was real hard, and I had no connections really in Chicago. And so I had to go back to being a stenographer, you know, and finally wound up a secretary at Goodyear Tire and Motor Company. And then my health broke. This was during the Depression, and mm-hmm. just the workhorses mm-hmm. remained in jobs. They're the only ones that, the ones that would just work from candle can't, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my health broke, and I went back to Texas. And then from there, I went to Louisville, Kentucky. I got on WHAS, which was CBS outlet. From there, I went back to Dallas and got on that early bird program I was telling you about, mm-hmm. the morning show.
Yeah.
Then I tried Chicago again. And I had had a lot of experience now, you know, with dance bands and radio. And then I got an agent in Chicago and finally wound up with the William Morris Agency, and I sang with J. Mills Orchestra at the Edgewater Beach Hotel, and then I had for 9 straight months at the Blackstone Hotel at the Balinese Room, and then at the Drake, and I sang at the Shea Paree in Chicago, which was a real hotshot night spot there. You know, they had very big names. I wasn't a big name, but I was like second on the bill, you know. And from there, while I was there, I was heard by the head of CBS, the network in Chicago, a man named Jack Van Valkenburg, who later became head of CBS television in New York. And he offered me a job on the staff at Columbia in Chicago. And Chicago was kind of the hub then, you know, on radio. And I was there for 2 years, and while I was there, I was heard by a casting director out here, a man named Danny Winkler, who was casting director for RKO. And he knew that they were doing a picture at Paramount called Holiday Inn with Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire.
Yes,
uh-huh. Uh-huh. And they were looking for an unknown, but someone that was had a radio following, because mm-hmm. there was no TVs.
Yeah.
And he couldn't agent me because he was a casting director, and so a friend of his named Joe Rifkin listened to me, and he started shooting wires to me in Chicago saying that they wanted to do a screen test, and I thought it was ridiculous, you know. I never had any idea of coming to Hollywood. My sights were on Broadway, you know. I wanted to do a musical. So anyway, he just kept wiring me until finally I went into the head of CBS there. I said, what do I do about this? He said, well, just go on out there, take the screen test, and have yourself a vacation. Mm-hmm. I expected nothing to come out of it. Well, actually, I was supposed to have danced with Fred Astaire.
Oh, wow.
You know, and to sing with Bing Crosby in this. And they never asked me if I could dance. So when I got out here, you know, Mr. Bill Michael John at Paramount was casting director, and he about had a fit when he found out I couldn't dance. But he said they would do the test anyway. They tested me in Fox, bought me on a year's contract. And I came out and I did a couple of walk-ons, really just bits. at Fox.
And what name were you under then at the
time? Dale Evans. Okay. I was given, I should back up and tell you the way I came by that name,
yes,
Dale Evans.
Yes.
In Louisville, Kentucky, I went by the name, I concocted a name of Marion Lee. And the casting director there said, everybody's name Lee, you know. I mean, the manager, the program director there. And he said, I want to give you a name that's different. And he said, you come back tomorrow and we'll talk about it. And when I went in, he says, I want to name you Dale Evans. I said, Dale Evans, for heaven's sake. I said, Dale is a man's name to begin with.
Yeah.
He said, no. He said, there was one of my favorite actresses, I think her name was Dale Winter. And he said, she was a very good actress, and said, I would like you to take that name, Dale, because it's unusual for a girl. And Evans is soft, euphonious, and easy to roll off the tongue for an announcer, and said, nobody can mispronounce Evans, Dale Evans. No way can they ever mispronounce your name. So that's the way I got the name Dale Evans. And from Fox, I went on the Chase and Sandman Hour with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah, that sounds a picture there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And from there, I went to Republic Studios, and I did about 8 pictures the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mr. Yates, who was head of Republic, had seen Oklahoma in New York, and he decided to make Roy's pictures really more musical, really more plot, more singing, more horses, more everything.
More,
you
know, budget.
More girl, you know, more part for the bigger part for the girl.
I hear a story that Gene Autry was working under Republic at the same time.
He had been there about 4 years when I went out there.
And he was having some kind of argument over money.
He was having an argument. That's why I think they signed another guy, because he was going to leave him.
Yeah, yeah.
His contract was up, I suppose. I don't know all the gory details of it, but they were threatened that he was going to quit, and he was number one at the time. And
I thought he went into the Air Force.
Yeah, he left for the Army.
No, that was later on.
Was it?
Yeah. they had this argument, and so he did leave. And actually, my first picture was a picture written for him.
I didn't know that.
Really?
It was called Washington Cowboy. I was a young congressman elected to Congress, and I went to Washington to help put out in this area where the ranchers were fighting over damming up these creek. You know, they didn't want it. The cattlemen didn't want it, but the other people needed it for irrigation, the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Washington as a young congressman to try to put this bill through, and that was the whole story. I put it through, and the fight was between the farmers wanted irrigation, and the ranchers didn't want the creek dammed up. And so that's what my first picture was about. And that picture was written for Gene Autry's next picture. So when Gene walked out, I was under contract there, and I'd been there from October the 13th, I told you earlier, and this was January, and I was beginning to think, well, my 6 months will be up pretty soon, and that'll be the end of that. Yeah. So they put me in it, and it was voted the Best Western of the year, and I got started off, went to third place in box office my first year.
So do you think really that the big budget really helped out?
Oh, later on, sure. When Gene started the first singing series, Westerns had hit a pretty low. They were making them on very low budgets.
Yeah.
And in those days, these little B houses, they didn't seat very many people, and they were paying 7 cents to 12 cents and odd number like that to get in the theater. So even if you had a house full, they still didn't make a lot of money. Gene got more theaters to take on the houses because they were the theaters to take on the Westerns because they were different and the people were going for them. And he was a recording star before he ever made the, mm-hmm. he was big in records before he made it. That's why they brought him out there. And I think you worked with, the first picture you worked in was singing something, Tumbleweeds or something, with Ken Maynard. Ken was under contract at the studio at that time, or was making pictures there. I don't know whether he's under contract or not, but Gene made the picture, and it just took off. And so he started making those musical westerns because the people liked the country music people, and basically they were country people and family people that liked our westerns. And they could kind of relate to them, a lot of them, because we still had a lot of ranchers and farmers and hillbillies, whatever you want to call them, that liked country music. And then they started writing big songs. The big band started playing Wagon Wheels and Gold Mine in the Sky, and a lot of Western songs at that time were big, way up on the hit parade. And the combination of everything brought the Westerns back. And Kristen and all the other studios started making musical Westerns. And
there were stories that they took almost the same scripts and the same songs from Gene Autry movies and passed them on to you, and certain scripts that you had used, Gene Autry would pick up and copy the exact same story and the same song.
I never knew that much about the inner workings of the writers.
Yeah.
I know that you see Westerns and you'll see a lot of similarities, but if it's new people doing it, it's a little different if it's a different location.
Uh-huh.
So, after all, there's only so many things you can do with a story for Westerns.
Were they the same writers that wrote for Gene?
A lot of them were the same writers, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yes, they were a lot of the same writers that wrote for Gene, wrote for me, and the Three Musketeers, and John Wayne, and all the other guys were under contract out there making series.
I have it down that in 1938 was your first film.
Right, I made
under
it.
Under Western Stars.
Under Western Stars, it was 1938 in January, 40 years ago.
Uh-huh. doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, time passes.
Sitting here, it doesn't. And it was a threesome kind of race. Tex Ritter hasn't been talked about till now. What was he like? Do you think it was a threesome race at a time with Gene Autry, Tex Ritter, and Roy Rogers?
No, we had. Of course, Hopalong Cassidy's series they'd bring a guy in to sing once in a while. His mostly, he had no music in him. He had Lucky, which the young fellow that played the kind of a comedy young guy. And of course, Jimmy Wakely came in later, Rex Allen came in, they were all singers, you know. And in fact, Jimmy Wakely had a trio in Oklahoma City, and he came out here and worked as a trio in some of my early pictures. And later on, one of the other studios picked him up and started him in a series. And Tex did that stage show, Green Grow the Lilacs in New York. And somebody saw him, and they brought him out Monogram brought him out and put him under contract and started his series. He came along later.
How did the name became the Cowboys story?
The King of the Cowboys, when I became number one, and I made a picture called The King of the Cowboys simultaneously when I hit number one in box office, 1943.
I think from my readings also that Gene Autry had a picture called something number one, too, wasn't it? Cowboy
number one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The King of the Cowboys came out a few years later.
I don't know how they came out routine-wise, but they were struggling for names. I mean, when they got that many series, Oklahoma, in old Oklahoma, Oklahoma Hills, and they'd sit in the office and try to come up with these. And some of them had nothing to do with the picture. Only they'd change the story around. It'd be sheep men one time, but they kept more music in them. because of the songs that became hit songs in the stage play. And fortunately, the first picture that Dale and I did together was actually the first, I think they put her in there because she sang and they were going musical. She wanted to do the musical. She didn't want to do any Westerns.
No, I mean, I couldn't ride.
You didn't want to be recognized as a Western.
Well, I wasn't really an outdoor type, you know, and I had done nightclubs and, you know, that wasn't my bag, let's face it.
Perfect trainer.
Well, we worked on it.
I mean, you know, I had not worked toward that. I'd never been an outdoor person, you know, and so I just didn't understand it. But what they wanted was a foil for Roy. They wanted the complete opposite.
She played a lot of nasty parts in the picture, like...
Yeah, I mean, they really didn't...
Writers for newspapers or magazines.
Part-wise, I was always kind of snippy and smart-alecky, and I played maybe a reporter, like, from New York or...
Chicago.
Very sophisticated type gal, you know.
And sang modern songs in the.
Yeah, and then he would really take me down a peg, you know, as a cowboy.
It made a good thing. The people.
That was
An early Sonny and Cher kind of.
Yeah,
that type.
Western
exactly,
Sonny
yeah.
And Cher. I like that.
That's a good comparison.
You kind of gave Jack Benny kind of stares at her at times.
Yeah, we had a few. She pushed me in the Big Bear, up at Big Bear. We were doing a picture, and the water was cold in this lodge they had up there. Had a nice swimming pool, and she got mad at me for something, pushed me in the swimming pool.
Well, because you had locked me in the stagecoach with a Limburger cheese, and I've gone over all this rough terrain.
So when I walked by, she pushed me in this swimming pool, and they had to take it five or six times. I like to froze to death.
Yeah.
But
Don't Fence Me In.
Yeah. And we took songs like that and give them the title of the picture.
Uh-huh.
And that's we sang
Navajo
the song.
Trail,
yeah, Along the Navajo Trail is the name of them. And they were always constantly looking for something that helped draw people, you know, and when a song became number one on the hit parade, there had to be a lot of people like it. And so they would try to get songs like that. And they had a lot of fine writers, you know, presenting songs to them all the time, to using different pictures.
I read that you had a tremendous fan club, and you had very little help from the studios
I had a lot of trouble with that. They wouldn't answer any of our fan mail. And I always thought that, boy, you get a fan mail from some kid, he struggled to write you a letter, and he broke his heart if he didn't get an answer.
Yeah.
So after I made my first picture, the fan mail started coming in, and I was only making $75 a week starring in those Westerns. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't make enough money to answer my fan mail.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't answer. The old man said, "Oh, don't pay any." Oh, I said, "The old man, it was my boss, Mr. Yates." He said, "Don't pay attention to those pictures, those letters you get. Says they don't mean anything." Well, I said, "They do to me." And I, at one time, we had four girls doing nothing but answering fan mail, and I had to go on the road and do personal appearances every time I got a few days off or weeks, whatever it was. I'd book it and play theaters all over the country, and
he did that to pay for his family.
The results was I had people that stuck with me through about four generations. You know, I have guys come in here. He says, "I wrote you a letter when I was 10 years old." Here he is, 40, you know, or 45, and I got a picture of you. And some of them will pull the picture out, and it's really threadbare, you know. But those are the things that make you feel good and make you feel like you haven't wasted your life on doing things like that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Just about every person I meet, I'm able to bring something from my collection that I have. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, they really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've seen some of the... You're a collector, so I'm sure you've seen this. But some of them, like one, for instance, is Vance Kolovic. He's a guy who plays Bozo. His father was Pinto Kolovic, who did the voice of Goofy for Disney. And he has a save with thing. He has one beat up 8x10 of him as Bozo.
You know, it's a shame. They get down later, especially if you have kids or a family, you know.
Uh-huh.
What are you going to leave them? You got to leave them a memory of growing up as their mother and father. But my kids can come here from now on, as you know, and relive their childhood. I've got the kids in there from babies right on up to their wedding. Now they can show them to their kids. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice thing for all those people that grew up in four generations, you might say, every 10 years, another generation.
Yeah, it's nice to see that period of time, because in this day, especially, that so many things are plastic, and it's just, you don't have the quality.
Well, you know, another thing, too, they're putting some terrible things on the screen, which I think there's a time and a place for everything, but I'm not a prude, but we had a haze office, they call it, when we were making our pictures. And if you got, they had to okay everything was said in that script, you know. You couldn't do, only so much blood could be shown. Maybe a little blood trickle out of the corner of your mouth or nose where you got socked in the nose, or a little black eye, but that was about the limit of it. Mm-hmm. You couldn't show people shooting in the stomach and blood flying in all directions and things like that. I thought it was a very healthy era, and I think I'm never for censoring too much, but I think we're reaping a lot of it from some of our youngsters today. I don't think it's doing a lot of them. Certain type of kids that are disturbed one way or the other, either their family, they can pick up a lot of these things that they see on the screen that, it's been proven that they've tried out some of them. They've already tried some of them. You take a picture like Walton's, for instance. There's a beautiful family. I can see it. Dale and I sit there and watch it, and I'll have tears one night. She'll have tears because it takes me right back home.
I have a phrase, Walton you out.
It's just, of course, losing Grandpa and Grandma had the stroke, you know. We've known her for many, many years in radio.
She was a script girl on our pictures.
Yeah.
She was a script girl, and I mean, I did pictures Ellen Corby. I did the first year I was at Republic, I did several pictures where she was a script girl. And she was a terrific script girl.
I wore those old bib overalls until I was about 16 years old. Even in my first year of high school, I only got 2 years of high school, and I had to go to work because depression
was. What do you do now without Grandpa in that series?
You know, show just keeps going on.
He was such color, you know, but he was such color.
Yeah. Well, I always wanted to get involved with the workshops he has out in Topanga Canyon.
Really?
And a good friend of mine, Sean Hannon, took his classes out there for about 12 years. And
you mean Will Gear?
Will Gear's class.
Yeah, he had workshops. How do you think he learned to be such a terrific actor?
He was marvelous.
He's been appearing on the Carson Show a bit, so, you know, he's really a colorful guy, you're right.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful. Well, back, you were just speaking of your 12-year-old period. Can we jump to that for a moment? I can piece all this together later. You're from Ohio?
I'll give you a quick. I was born on born in Cincinnati, and to bring you up to date, I was born in the area where they just built a few years ago the Riverfront Stadium for the Cincinnati Reds. Well, they bulldozed my home, my birthplace, over, and built the Riverfront Stadium, so I claim second base as my first birthplace. And then I was just 2 years old when we left there, and my dad and his brother built a houseboat. And I lived on the houseboat with my three sisters and I for 5 years. And I guess Dad figured he better get her feet on the ground, so he bought a little farm out of Portsmouth, Ohio, about where he was raised. About 12 miles out of Portsmouth, a little place called Duck Run. And I was there through the rest of my schooling, and I got through 2 years of high school. And I went to Cincinnati and got a job in a shoe factory and was working there when I came to California.
What did Pop do when you lived on the house?
He worked his whole life in a shoe factory.
But you lived on a boat, too?
He worked, until we came to California, he'd worked 35 years in the shoe factory.
When you were in the houseboat?
Yeah, he was working at the Excelsior Shoe Company.
You saw the shoe, shoe thing here, didn't you? Did you know?
The boots, where the boots are thing. In the museum.
Oh, there's
Well, there's some pictures of my dad and I in there. And I held on to that because that was my first job, was in a shoe factory.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Happy Trails. Is that a song that you have written?
No, yeah. That did that one.
Dale wrote it. It's I used to sign my pictures, many happy trails, happy trails.
He wrote a verse about
trails music. Of happiness.
A verse to it.
And things like that. And so when we did our series of TVs, we had to have a theme song. Mm-hmm. So if you use somebody else's, you have to pay them every time it plays, you know, which would have cost. So
yes.
Dale wrote the Happy Trail.
Well, back up to when we did Quaker Oats with Frank Worth. That's when I wrote Happy Trails at Mutual Network. Well, and Roy used
what
a
I
song.
Mean, we used a song we had.
Yeah,
we
used
owned.
A song called Don't Forget Smiles Are Made Out of the Sunshine for a theme. And it's a cute song, really cute song. But I didn't think it sounded like a cowboy. And I had seen him sign his pictures, many happy trails, so many times. And I thought, happy trails, that he should have a trail song. You know, and I always liked Fertigrove Fay's Grand Canyon Suite, because it's that, you remember the Philip Morris cigarette music? Da-da-da, you know, and then that high trombone that go way up there and then drop almost like an echo in the canyon. And I would listen to that, da-da-da, you know, like an octave drop.
Yeah.
And that's the way Happy Trails was born. Happy Trails to you.
It has that bump, bump, bump.
Yeah, but it was the idea of the echo from a canyon. You know, like sundown, a guy riding down on a horse down the canyon and singing out an echo and it coming back. That was the concept, you know, for Happy Trails. And after I got the first line, then the rest of it was easy. Then about 2 years ago, Roy recorded for 20th Century Fox Records. And he wrote a verse to it.
It needed longer for the record.
Which verse did you write?
To fit the Happy Trails to you, I said, some trails are happy ones, others are blue. It's the way you ride the trail that counts. Here's a happy one for you. Happy trail.
Yeah.
To you. And we generally start off with the chorus and do the verse in it.
That's a good lead-in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, get their attention. Can I mention that, or is it if it's not important, it's not important, really, because this is your spread. Arlene Wilkins.
That was my first wife.
Would you like me to mention?
That was my wife that died when my boy was born.
You should, on account of Dusty and Linda. I said you should. On
yeah, well, I didn't know
what
you wanted to talk. Sure, we can talk about it.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is just kind of, give a
well,
a bit of history.
I was, I mentioned earlier when we were bringing in the early part, the barnstorming trip down through New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas.
Yes.
We were stuck in Roswell, New Mexico, on our little radio station there, trying to make enough money to go on. And we'd kid one another over the air. We got the idea that kidding one another over the radio station what we like to eat. I like lemon pies, and somebody else like fried chicken, some like hot biscuits. And we had people bringing stuff to the studio. And one day I got a phone call that if I would sing the Swiss Yodel, they would have a lemon pie down there. Well, I sang it. Boy, I'll tell you. And the next day, we had two big meringue lemon pies down at the studio. And that was 1933. We corresponded, and she came out here, and I went back there, and we got married in 1936 on our way to the Texas Centennial.
And you were married here, weren't you?
No, we were married in Roswell.
Who told me you were married at Wee Kirk of the Heather?
No, not me, not us.
That's wild. Somebody told me that you were married. Maybe that was Don and Eileen that
that's
were married.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. it. That's her brother.
That's her brother.
Daughters? Huh? Was born in Presbyterian. I mean, I was married at a Presbyterian hospital in Whittier.
What?
Wasn't one of your sons or daughters married at the Presbyterian Church? In Whittier.
No. Mm-mm.
Where was Candy married?
Candy was married in Los Gatos.
Both of them.
Both of Candy and
Candy somewhere Mindy? I read that somebody was married in Whittier.
No.
No.
Mm-mm.
No.
No. None of our children. Because our oldest daughter was married in Encino, mm-hmm. St. Nicholas Episcopal Church.
Well, you know,
Linda Lou and Gary Roy's own daughter. The first one was adopted. The first mm-hmm. daughter, and Linda Lou and Gary eloped to Las Vegas, and Dusty, and Roy Jr. and his wife were married in the Methodist Church in Middlefield, Ohio. And our little Scottish girl was married in our home in Chatsworth. And
Dodie.
And Dodie was married at our Presbyterian church here, Church of the Valley Presbyterian.
That might be the one. That was the latest.
And
one.
My son was married at Fountain Avenue Baptist Church in Hollywood.
Roy Rogers Jr. is a spitting image of you.
Do you think so?
He's a lot bigger than I am. He's 6'4".
That's funny. I can see some, but I think he looks more like his mother's people. Like Roy in through here, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, Dusty, when we got married, we were married 4 years, no children, and in the meantime, I'd been visited. I'd got started in pictures, and I played a lot of orphanages. When I'd go on to do those one-night stands, and I'd play hospitals, entertaining the kids. And I got into a hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, and a little three-year-old girl got a hold of my leg. And I lifted her up, and I carried her all the way through here. Did the whole show with her in my arms. When I got ready to leave, the nurses had this terror out in my arms. And all she could say is, take me with you, take me with you. And I didn't get over that. I was on my way home, and I stopped in Dallas. And I was telling the guys that had our distribution in Dallas, Bill O'Donnell and Bob O'Donnell and Bill Underwood were the two guys. And I asked them if they happened to have any ideas where I could adopt a child. They said, you're talking to the right guys. I think you're guided in a lot of these things. And they told me about Hope Cottage. I said, can we go over there now? They said, sure. So they put me in their car. We went over, it was a couple of miles from the distributor place there. And there were 42 babies in there. And I started through, and I got through, I don't know, a third of the way through, and this little head popped up and looked at me, 6 weeks old. That's our oldest daughter. She got four kids, beautiful kids. And then
adoption was kind of a popular thing.
It was hard. Well, it was hard to adopt a child at that time.
Then.
Yes, the woman come out here and lived 2 weeks with us in our home before she'd okay it.
Really?
Yeah. And she came all the way out here from Texas.
Even though you're Roy Rogers.
It didn't make any difference to her. She wanted to see what it was like at home, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, we adopted the child, and then my wife got pregnant. We had two, Linda Lou and Dusty. And 6 days after Dusty was born, Arlene died of embolism, blood clot. And then
cesarean.
Yeah, And of course, Dusty's 31 now, and all the kids are married, and we have 16 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren.
It's funny, the oldest adopted child and the youngest adopted child came from the same place, Hope Cottage in Dallas.
Mm. Well, see, when Dale and I got married after I lost my wife, she married me with not only 3 babies, you might say, but 35 coon dogs. I had a whole pack of hounds, and she took on quite a load.
Where were you living at the time then?
We were living
Hollywood.
Studio City, and we bought a place in Hollywood when we were going to get married. And we lived right
well,
up
at right
Ivorine, up
Ivorine,
above
the
freeway.
Vine Street.
Goes up in those hills.
A big Spanish house.
Yeah, it's a kind of a Spanish
Noah
type.
Noah Beery, the silent screen star. Yeah. It was his home.
Yeah, he built it. So we had about 4 acres there, wasn't it?
Big place. All terraced, just
sounds,
sat
yeah,
on a hillside.
Yeah, sounds beautiful. Yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. It was.
Yeah. And then you moved up to
we moved to Encino.
We lived 4 years in Encino, and then we went to Chatsworth. We were there 12,
we
11
4
years.
Weeks in, 4 years? Is that all we were in Encino?
4 years. We were 4 years in Hollywood and 4 years in Chatsworth, in Encino, and then we went to
Chatsworth. Mm-hmm.
And then you had a big, 144 acres?
And 138 acres.
138.
Mm-hmm.
And you expanded your home there? And
yeah, and that's where we really raised the kids.
No, we're there 10 years.
11. 10 or 11. 11 years, uh-huh. I think, was because we've been up here. It'll be 13 years in June.
This is the longest we've lived in any place.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We'll probably die right here.
Yeah, we love the desert. It grows on you.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yes, I can. Excuse
the longer
me,
you...
go ahead and talk.
The longer here, you better better you like it. I let things store up, and I hate to go to L.A. until I get 3 or 4 or 5 things I can take care of in 1 or 2 days, and I go down and do it, and then come back.
Well, didn't you live in Arizona for a while also?
No, I never lived in Arizona. I had some property over there. I was very interested in property several years ago, in and around Phoenix. I still got 160 acres over there. Me and another fella.
Do you,
I loved,
own a lot of land?
Huh?
Do you own a lot of land spread around different places?
When this heart thing started coming along, you know, started getting rid of land, and I really did all right with my property. I still got several pieces up here, but I've sold my last piece down there about the first of the year.
What happened with your heart?
Well, about 22 years ago, I was hunting up in Utah, and I had what they call an angina attack. It's angina pectoris. It was 9,000 feet elevation and oxygen kind of thin up there anyway. And I started to go up this hill and I couldn't get very far. I'd start puffing and my arms started hurting. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was the altitude. And I got home and I kept having these attacks. So I went to a heart specialist and he looked at that electrocardiograph and he says, what's your schedule? And I reeled off all we'd planned for this coming summer. This is like in January. Oh, we had three, Edmonton, Ottawa, Calgary, and 6 state fairs coming up
state
that summer. Yeah. And so he said, cancel them. I said, you don't know what you're saying. You know, there's a lot of money.
Yeah.
He said, well, you better cancel them. And I took his advice, and I canceled them. And I, in about five, took it real easy for 5 or 6 years, and I got to feeling better, and I started booking things again and getting back into the other things and TV shows and things.
The papers came out with, you know, Roy Rogers is back.
It may have been. I don't.
I saw some kind of paper section there.
It could have been. Or it might have been a couple, 3 years ago when I made that other picture. But I came back from my examination and just took it easy. And about 7 years ago, it stabilized to where I can bowl and hunt and shoot trap and live a normal life, only not as fast.
Don't push.
Don't move as fast.
Yeah.
And so I... 6 years ago, I've had the same doctor since then, and he told me that said one of these days you're going to have open heart surgery, and he says I'll keep an eye on it. So every year I go back, and he could
to correct the damage.
Yes, and of course you can't tell what the damage is until you look in there, and they have an angiogram that you have to take. So he held me off for about 6 years by watching the electrocardiograph to see if there's any changes taking place in my heart. So last fall, I told him I was getting shorter and shorter of breath. So he said, you better come down. So I came down, and And he put me on the electric autograph machine, and he said, well, that time has arrived. We've been talking about it for about 6 or 7 years. He said, you're going to have an angiogram. So I did, and they took one look at it. And the next day I was in the hospital for open heart surgery. And the doctor told me that the attack that I had 22 years ago just left one little scar, but it didn't damage the heart muscle. He said the heart muscle was like a man 35 years old in the tissues, and which accounts for my recovery as fast. I've been, since January, and here it is May, I've been bowling for over a month, and I'm running walking 3 miles a day, and part of that's jogging. And I'd forgotten what it was like to feel normal, and I just can't believe the things that they're doing today. And my advice is, anybody that has any inclination, well, first of all, always have a checkup every once in a while, once a year anyway, because I hear of these young guys, 38 and 39, 40, in their early 40s, popping off with heart attacks. A lot of those things can be headed off if they, with just a checkup on an electrocardiograph. It shows a lot of it.
So you say you're feeling much better now?
Oh, I feel like I did 25 years ago.
That's great to hear.
I can't believe it. I can do just about anything I want to. Of course, I do a routine of exercise, which I've always done. Uh-huh. But now I can do it without my arms hurting, you know?
Now, you live in Apple Valley?
Now? Yes, it's about 10 miles from here. We're looking for a place in Victorville so we'll be closer to the museum, because I make several trips over here today and go through and shake hands with the people and play Roy Rogers. And it's like meeting home folks, you know.
If I would just stopped off the freeway and was going through the museum and saw you walk out, it
would be... Well, you should see some of the reactions I get. It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
It makes you really appreciate what you've done.
I can see that. What are the projects you see in the future for yourself? Copy Gene and Me. How has that been coming along? Is it steady out now?
It was something. Yeah, that one. If I was going to do another one, I would. I'd have to get a bunch of new songs and do it. But I'm not particularly interested, because I don't need to do. I'd rather spend my time. I have 220 Roy Rogers family restaurants around over the country. We go to those openings of new ones, and I'm busy.
I have for a while in my area, and then they folded.
Well, when this first started, it started with a chain called Roby's, Marriott Corporation, and I have the restaurants, and. They bought these Roby's, and a lot of them were in bad locations. They already had signed up a franchisee, which panned out. He wouldn't live up to any of our rules. And it's a fresh, all of our food is fresh, the meat and everything. It's not frozen. Everything is served fresh, and it's a fast food operation. And it's taken us a while to get a lot of the bugs out.
Would it be close to an Arby's?
No, we've got more. Arby's, theirs is more or less on a sandwich, roast beef sandwich. We have a variety of hamburgers, cheeseburgers, and it's all fresh meat. And
Carl's kind of?
Yeah, that type of thing. And fried chicken. And we've developed a bigger menu of fast food, and it's really going good. We have the center of our... business, or whether we have more restaurants, is Washington, D.C. We have about 60 some right in and around Washington, D.C.
60.
And 28 or something like that, Philadelphia, 14 over to Baltimore, and 9 or 10 Long Island and New Jersey and Maryland.
How much attention do you have to pay to all that?
Hmm?
How much attention does that require of you?
Well, I have an open wire to Marriott Company in Washington, D.C., and it's more or less up to me what time I can spend as far as going to the openings. I told them I can't go to all of them, you know.
How many openings do you think you've made to your restaurant?
I don't know. We did 4 in a row last year, and I try to get them to get 3 or 4 together so we can take a week and cover 3 or 4, yes. You know what I mean? Because you have the press, and you have the press parties at each little town you go to, wherever that's located. And then you have the opening. We have a PA system, and we talk to the people and sing. Last summer, I took the Son of the Pioneers, and we had a ball doing the show. So now they're preparing to do some more this summer. But California, one guy, they made the mistake in the early beginning of this thing. One guy had too much area, and he overextended himself, and he didn't do a good job in any of them. So those are the ones that went out of business here in California. But I had nothing to do with it. It was a matter of some of the restaurants they bought in the package to start with. And they had no parking area. Wasn't the architectural setup that we have now. We've got our own building company that builds each one of them, and we know what they're supposed to look like, you know. I have a new poster out there I'll show you. Before you go, it's going up in all of our new restaurants. It'll go up in all of them, but they did a beautiful job on it. It's something like a billboard, like a poster out in front of a theater, but it talks about the fresh food.
Forgive me for jumping around. You mentioned that that the Roy Rogers Show is now in syndication in different countries.
Yeah, it's well, you see now, television's been on, 30-some years? It doesn't seem like it, but it has. In the 40s it started. And in the last 10 years, everything's been color. So they get first choice. So you see very few black and white pictures except the big epics. You know, like some of the pictures were in black and white.
You see Gene Autry, but that's on Channel 5.
Yeah, that'd be on his own station.
Yeah, wouldn't you know?
Yeah, I saw one in the paper yesterday. It was on at 12:30 last. Who's going to get up at 12:30?
Gene Autry?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever there's a
if I owned the station,
time,
I'd give it a little better time.
Puts it in. Whenever
yeah.
Has a space.
But they were.
Have they ever dubbed in a different language, for instance?
Oh, yes, all over the world. I met the guy that did my voice in Portuguese down in Brazil when I was traveling with our commercial tie-ups. Oh. Sears Roebuck people opened a store down there, and I went down because they sold they had Roy Rogers Corrals in all their stores and sold tons of that stuff.
How many different Roy Rogers?
We had around 400 articles. Between the two of us, all of different things.
But I mean, I've been products?
Yeah.
400 different.
Yeah, beds, bread spreads, guns, and
caps,
pistols, and.
Pajamas.
Yeah, pajamas, and everything. And it was quite an era. It's the same thing that they're doing today with
they don't see that many.
Charlie's Angels, you know, they have TV they can advertise them on now. We didn't have. As much that in those days,
yeah.
And it was too expensive to start it. But now everything's gone up so much, your dollar doesn't go very far. You take a bushel basket to get you very little groceries.
What was the last? Not the most recent, but the last of the 188 films.
I don't know. I had nothing to do with my old films. I have a friend that's made a deal with the people that owned them, bought them from Republic, and he's got the home rights for 8mm, 16mm, and 35 if they've got that kind of a setup, for all of my pictures and a lot of the other pictures. His name's Snuff Garrett. He's the one that produced my album, Hoppy, Gene, and Me. And he's really going with it. He's got this nostalgia magazine out.
He does that also.
He started this and got in the black in the first two issues. And he has different cowboys on the front.
I should subscribe to.
Yeah, that would be a good thing because you might get, there's a lot of information.
Yeah, mail your order to Nostalgic Merchant, 6255 Sunset Boulevard.
He's right there by the Home Savings, right there between Vine and Gower, uh-huh. on the north side of the street. It'd be a good idea to go in there and talk to him because you're all the different things you're interested in. Because he's got even Shirley Temple and he tied up a whole bunch of.
You have that beautiful Shirley Temple collection.
Yeah.
I almost bought one of those Shirley Temple cups just like that for $22.
Is that right?
That was with the face almost unrecognizably scratched.
You know? No fooling.
Yeah, yeah. I try and get all I can. This looks great.
Well, Snuff is a collector of art and everything. He came out here about 12, 15 years ago and slept in his car for I don't know how long, and he got to producing, went to work for a record company, and he finally ended up owning his own record company. He produced Sonny and Cher's records and those million sellers that. And he really got to going, and he's a going dude, I'll tell you. He never stops. He's 39 and just done terrific. And he's the one that's got all these pictures. And he grew up on my pictures, and that's how we come to get together on the Hoppy Gene and Me album.
You even signed posters for him,
too. Oh, yeah, I signed a bunch of them. We signed them in there.
That's great. I have to get a
yeah, it comes out, I think, every month. This is April. Yeah, here's number two. Got, I think I was on the first one, and this is Tim McCoy. And this one came out with Burt Reynolds. They're good friends. And let's see.
Tell me, with all those movies you did, is there something that if you had a chance to do them all over again that you wouldn't do, or something you would want to do more of?
No, I don't think so. We had a lot of action.
Have you changed your style at all through the years? Have you changed your style at all through the years?
I don't think so. I appreciate my being brought up in the era that I was brought up in during the Depression and seeing the other side of the track. I can't gamble. You know what I mean? I can't go out and bet horses or gamble. And I think it goes back to those early days when it was hard to find something to eat, you know. And I can appreciate it, but money doesn't mean that much to me. I could get by if I didn't have a nickel. I'd get by some way. I always had wheels and a way to get around. And my cousin and I, when I first came out here, when we were picking peaches up there, we'd get on a motorcycle and ride all the way down and on Main Street. There's a little Greasy Spoon restaurant down there that you could get a whole quarter of a pie for a nickel. And we'd ride all the way down there and fill up on pie and ride back to Lawndale. And things like that are memories that, at the time, you know, everybody, they say, what was it like during the Depression? You say, compared to what? The rich ones were jumping out of 20-story buildings and the poor ones were scratching for something to eat. So it all equals out. They couldn't eat any more than I could, you know.
Did you ever get a star on Sunset Boulevard?
Oh, yeah. I've got three of them on there.
Three of them?
Yeah. Radio, television, and pictures. Yeah.
Do you know where are they all located?
I don't know. There's one close to, what's that theater where they used to do?
Mine's right in front of the Hollywood Palace.
There's one down
right in front. Mm-hmm.
In front of the palace.
Yeah, mine's right in front of the Hollywood Palace.
There's
Romans.
One of mine is
Pantages.
On Vine. Egyptian. There by that big theater. We used to have TV shows out of
there. That's the Hollywood Palace.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, I got one there. El Capitan Theater years ago.
And one up on Hollywood Boulevard someplace, and one down on that street that goes down by the Derby.
And I take it those were all achieved a long time ago?
Oh, yeah. Well, radio. See, we were doing radio.
Never knew when mine was in there. I was surprised to see it. One day I just didn't think about it. It was there.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know when it went in or anything.
They didn't send the Walk of Fame mean he didn't send you a letter?
No, they just put me there. In
well, you see, it was a matter of fact thing when they first started it. So they took people that were popular at the time. And now, as TV people come along, they're adding them, people, and the new stars.
You have to sponsor yourself now, or somebody has to sponsor you to do it. It's a different thing than it was. You have to, did you know that?
The what?
Somebody has to sponsor you now and pay for the whole thing. Did you know that?
No.
Well,
the Sons of the Pioneers got, I was down to theirs a couple of years ago, a couple, 3 years ago.
Somebody,
That's great.
Somebody shelled out.
Really? I didn't know how they were.
Yeah, but now it's different from what it used to be. They have a regular committee and, you know, you make a donation and there's someone that you think that should be in there and then you make a donation for them and that's the way it is done now.
Do you ever appear on the cover of Life magazine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's in there in the museum. I was on the cover of the year I became King of the Cowboys, 1943.
Really?
It's in that, you go down, if you stay to the left and go around, clear to Trigger Jr. and come back, I've got enough publicity, front page stuff and everything, to paper the whole walls in there, and I've kept all this. It's back here in boxes and stuff. But I've only got one panel, one display of publicity, and you can see it now. There's some front pages of the New York Mirror and Times and stuff like that I had put mounted under plastic, you know, so it wouldn't deteriorate. I don't know what condition some of those things we got folded up in those boxes. We haven't been open for 30 years.
Something I forgot to touch upon, and that is I read that you proposed to Dale while you were on a
horse.
And what do you call those stop
Chicago,
gates or whatever?
Yeah.
Chicago, just getting ready to go into be introduced. Yeah. We were sitting out on our horse, just getting ready to be introduced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you consider yourself a shy man? Is that why you waited to that point?
I've always been a shy guy. She can tell you, I hate parties with a passion. I can't carry on a conversation with strange people. I got to know people.
Uh-huh.
We have to have something in common to, you know. And I'm not as bad as I was, because after all, you don't live 66 years without having a couple of things to talk about. But I never will forget some of those parties. If I got stuck in the corner with a stranger, I was a lost cause.
Uh-huh. it's difficult for Roy Rogers to be impolite. You have to
kind of
stick up your image all the time.
Yeah, I was always scared to death when I got invited to a party. And in the old days, they had quite a few of them, you know. I was surprised, and I'd forgotten about the situation until it was mentioned. We just were down in Oklahoma for this Cowboy Hall of Fame presentation. Uh-huh. And where's that picture?
Started a museum there?
Oh, they've got a big museum called the Cowboy Hall of Fame. And he was taken in this year. We were taken in 2 years ago. And we were at a party at Sunny Tufts, and there was a whole bunch of stars there. And what's his name, honey?
Ford?
Glenn. Hit up trying to think of too many things.
Yeah.
Oh, Glenn was there, and I'd forgotten about it. And so down when he went in, about 3 weeks ago, when they took him into the Cowboy Hall of Fame, Gene was there. He's been the president this last year of the Cowboy Hall of Fame. And Glenn got up and told the story. He says, I feel like Roy had a big help in my success in Westerns. He says, I was at this party and his hats always looked so good, you know. And he asked me, how do you block your hats? So I took his hat and took it and stuck it under the shower and fixed it right there in front of everybody. And he says, Roy, that's the same hat I wore in all these pictures. you can get them wet and that felt just molds like clay, you know. Uh-huh. But making sure it's in the position you want it in when it dries, because I've generally put them over a rolled up towel or something so they'll hold a position. Every little thing, whatever, whichever way it dries, it stays that way unless you re-wet it again.
Is his name Nudie? Is that his name? Is that how you pronounce it?
Nudie.
The one who
Nudie.
Designs.
Oh, Nudie.
Mm-hmm.
Nudie.
How did you meet with him? Did he start the Liberace kind of flashy?
Yeah, I was one of the,
was really the first.
One of the first ones to start with Nudie.
The Cowboys.
How was that received? You say it's a first. I mean, how was it received when you?
Well, he was a struggling tailor, you know, and I was one of his customers. And at that time, I'd already started doing fringe and stuff like that. And because I was making modern pictures, I wasn't making. They were buckskin, but they were modern buckskin. And then I started putting the sequins on them. And
Did Marge Riley used to do some
stuff? Marge Riley used to make some of them.
She's in Palm Springs now.
And Turk used to make them out there on Ventura Boulevard. But doing personal appearances and being so far away from your people in the middle of a rodeo arena like Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, you need something.
You at least they could see you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Literally.
If you got out there in some drab cowboy outfit, this is why rodeo cowboys wear the satin shirts and stuff on. It's like a parade day, you know?
With the white trims.
You had the PA system. You could reach them with your voice, but they couldn't see anything. Your features very good unless he had field glasses with him. So I dressed accordingly. So at least they could hear me coming in with those when the spotlights hit those sequins, or not sequins, but the rhinestones. They really show up.
Yeah.
You come alive.
There's been so much talk on the trigger in your museum.
Mm-hmm. Well,
on that at all?
You mean having him mounted?
Yeah.
No, I thought about
it
a lot, but we get some people, but some people gripe about anything, you know. Some of these people, I don't pay any attention to them anymore.
So
for the first reason, you know how I answer them?
Really?
Somebody will say, Roy, I can't see how you could do that to Trigger. I said, would you rather I'd bury him and have the worms eat him up?
Yeah.
Father.
Well, I'd like to have that printed. I'm tired of answering these questions.
Yeah, well, maybe so.
That's what happens to him.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you see, that's why I brought this book.
For the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, people can go there and see Trigger.
Yeah.
That's right.
I argued with him when he said he was going to do it. I didn't want him to. And yet he was right. Because the people,
you'd be surprised to hear the comments.
I tell you, most of them, you know, they come and they just look at that horse. And
I've seen them, tears come down out of their cheeks.
Eyes, you know, really, and remembered back when they were kids, you know, how they loved the horse. And really, and it's...
I think people tend to think when you do something like that, that you just absolutely have no feelings. And
they do.
You do have feelings. I mean,
sure.
You know.
Well, my feeling was I just hated to bury him. That's all, and not see him anymore.
Yeah.
And I've been in museums where they do such a beautiful job mounting animals of all over the world. You know, Smithsonian Institute, and different places, of different animal families where they preserved them. Some of them have become extinct, but they preserved them where the kids can see them today. What they were like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's the way I felt about it. I feel that as long as they're kids, they'll love horses. And the kids in those days, when they thought of a cowboy, they didn't only think of a cowboy, they thought of his horse. It's Roy Rogers and Trigger's one, you know, or Lone Ranger and Silver and Gene Autry and Champion.
Out there, he says. The horse is just waiting for you.
Well, I'll tell you, if there's a heaven for horses.
That's something that, you see, I mentioned to a few of my friends when I mentioned that I'm coming here.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. They say right away, he's the one who stuffed his horse. You know, he'll probably be next. You know,
mm-hmm.
Without even reading it.
Well, tell you how ignorant they are when they say stuff their horse. They don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
It's made out of fiberglass. That goes, they're ancient thinking to start with. They haven't kept up with the times. That goes back to the stuff in the little rag dolls, you know, with the Excelsior and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When 30, 40 years ago, Since fiberglass, since World War II, everything's, boats and everything's been made out. Well, they make, they take the measurements of the horse and make the mold exactly the measurements. Then they make the mold out of fiberglass and they stretch the skin over the fiberglass and put it
so
back together.
That's really all it is the skin and
it's
some
just
glass
the skin.
Eyes. And
yeah. That's right.
Right.
Just the skin and the
but
coat.
But you can take a picture of that and take a picture of Trigger when he's live and you can't tell which one's which.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I saw the pictures. It's
yes.
amazing.
It's mm-hmm. just the idea that some people are squeamish about it. You know what I mean? They, you know, but I was myself. I wasn't myself when he first said he was going to do it.
Well, the way I was raised, I wasn't. I had to do all the butchering and everything else on the farm when I was a kid. And my dad was a city guy, and he wouldn't even kill a chicken.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.